to have you help me welcome Carla R. from Tujunga as our speaker tonight.
Hi, everybody. My name's Carla Rell, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to start by thanking Lee for the invitation to come up here and share with you guys tonight. It is always a privilege to do anything in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, anytime, anywhere, really. And Mike for the follow-up and making sure that I got the address and knew where to come. And it's good to see you guys all tonight out here on a Saturday night celebrating sobriety. And I love that we read the long form of the 12th tradition, you know, anonymity being the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Everything that we do based on that. When I was new, I heard them say, go out there and try to do something for somebody and not get caught, you know. And, you know, it can be tough sometimes because I want credit, you know. I want to know, I want credit where credit is due, and maybe even some of yours too. But I love that. It causes me to start to give things away for fun or for free, you know, to give it away for fun or for free. Good spirit, good cheer, good help somebody. Hold a door open for a second for somebody walking behind you, just for the hell of it, you know, just for the hell of it. And then it goes way beyond that, but I just love that tradition, and I love all of them. My sobriety date is September 25th, 1987, just 3 short months later than my husband got sober. He likes you to know that. Whenever we get into an argument, he says, oh, honey, just wait 3 months, you'll understand. But I tell him that they're man months so that we're really even, you know. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought maybe it was very important to try to figure out why I'm an alcoholic. Is it my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family? If you had my family, you'd drink too, is what I thought, you know. And now I've been around here long enough to know that that'll give you an inventory, but it didn't make me alcoholic. Not one bit. Not one bit. And why do I know that? I know that because I've been around and I pay attention. You know, and I know, I had one of those childhoods. My family, we loved each other, but we really couldn't hang, you know. We just really couldn't hang. There was a lot of trouble, a lot of chaos, a lot of violence, a lot of, you know, just stuff, and not everybody has. And my husband comes from a family where he was loved and wanted and needed. He had everything, you know. They had, yeah, their living challenges and stuff, you know, but mostly they grew up singing together, you know what I mean? They were that family, you know, like his dad painted the family pickup the color of his high school. You know what I mean? Jeez. I mean, I still, when we leave, we'll go have dinner with his family, and then we leave, I get a little sugar headache. You know what I mean? It's just so sweet. But he sits right next to me in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? Because alcohol did for and to him exactly what it did for and to me. And we let it do that for a long, long time, right? Just trying to eke out that last bit of, you know, whatever that alcohol did for us at the time. And I need to remember too, you know, we talk a lot about what might send us out, you know, what kind of emotional pain we might get into that might be bad enough to send us out. But I've got to remember too that I can't drink on a good day either. You know, I need to, that first half of the first step, I need to swallow whole. I used to drink on good days, used to drink on days I didn't like, you know, sun came up, sun went down, I was drinking. And now, through the power and the process of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not thinking about alcohol at all. Not like that. Not that horrible obsession was lifted. You know, the thought to drink might come. On a summer day, see a cold beer. That looks nice. But sanity being restored, I can go, yeah, but not for me. It's not for me. So I need to remember that. After that first half of the first step, the rest of those steps protect that. They protect it. You know, I will never be so spiritually fit that I can take a drink of alcohol in any form at all. Not on the best day of my life will I be able to do that. I need to remember that. I see a lot of people, you know, it will never not be about alcohol for me. You know, and I get scared when I hear people say that it's not about the alcohol. I've seen people with 30, 40 years, 40 years. 2 years ago, a guy with 40 years went out. So I need to remember I can't drink on a good day either. And most of the time, you know what? I mean, for the last 30 years, I have not been running away from a drink. I have not been hiding from a drink. I take the steps, and after, well, I need to qualify that. I was about 9 months sober when the horrible obsession to drink was lifted for me. And so I am living proof that you can be here for 9 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, not feel like it, and get to stay sober anyway. And I think that's very important, because every single day up until the time it was lifted, I was taking steps, not grudgingly, but not knowing if this thing was going to work. My mother was a single mother of two girls, and she moved us around a lot for the rent. And I'm not one of those alcoholics either who just, you know, at 6 years old ran out to the Boulevard of Broken Dreams and started smoking cigarettes. You know what I mean? It's like I was kind of a social kid. I had fun. I was always a new kid on the block at school a lot, and so whatever it was we were doing at the new school, I wanted to do it too. If we were playing softball, let's do that. If we were doing school politics, I'm in. You know, academics, put me in. And I've got a little bit of a competitive bone, and that doesn't make me alcoholic. It can make me a big pain in the ass. So I started to be a little kid with big dreams, and I started to want to be the first woman president, the first woman Major League Baseball player, the first woman to run a 4-minute mile, you know, like that, you know, just kind of revving up. And God, by the time sixth grade was over, I was tired and I needed a drink, you know. And the deal was, when I took that drink, it worked. It worked for me. And that does not happen for 90% of the population. It just doesn't do for a non-alcoholic what it did for me. And for us alcoholics. I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. And I know they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business, don't they? They just do my best to spin the bottle. It was that summer going up into junior high. I was with a few friends, some boys and some girls at my friend Leonard's house, and we were passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey and playing spin the bottle. And the bottle we were spinning landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut. And I did not think that was fair. I still don't think it's fair if you want to know the truth. But every sponsor I've ever had has told me that the fair comes around once a year and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get. So I grew up with these ideas, and I would bump up against somebody else's ideas, and I didn't know how to accept the things I couldn't change or change the things I could. Didn't understand it. So socially, tried to stay in for a while, and then I gave up. And I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom and hanging out with the other girls who were doing the same thing. I got a reputation I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for, and I just started to let go. Now, home wasn't working, and neither was school. And these weren't the first drinks I ever took, but these were the ones where I really, really got that alcohol did something for me I couldn't do for myself. When alcohol came into my life, it intervened in a way that nothing else could. And if you're alcoholic like I am, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, it became my spirituality. It became my growing up muscle. It was the thing that buffered me from you and the thing that connected me to you. It did it all, and I let it. It was pretty efficient. And back then I'm still not a good spectator in my life. It takes me a little bit to settle down and to understand the things that... to not try to take charge, you know, and I would roll up my sleeves and try to take over the management of my life, and I'd get out there. My favorite place to be back then was on my way to somewhere else. I love that place. I'd get out on the on-ramps of the 101 freeway coming north and the 10 freeway going east, and I'd stick my little thumb out on that on-ramp, and I'd crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I would be on my way to somewhere else, and I love that feeling. That feeling felt like freedom to me, like any minute now we're all going to be okay. And I'd sit out there in the starry open sky, and I just feel like I was taking charge of my life. And because I was so young, I started ending up in some of the Southern California hotspots, like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and LA Central Juvenile Hall. We did that whole dance for a while. And when I was 14, I left home one more time with a friend of mine, and we ended up in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area, you know, party town. We got one long ride all the way up there, and the guy dropped us off, and we stood there for just a minute. And, you know, we were little kids in the bright lights and big city, and looked to my left, and there was Carol Doda and her flashing boobs in neon. And to my right were hookers and dealers and pimps, oh my. And We weren't on that street for 10 minutes before a couple of guys approached us, offered us money for sex, and we said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And Dr. Silkworth talks about in the chapter The Doctor's Opinion that after a time we can't differentiate the true from the false. After a while, our alcoholic lives seem the only normal one. And I couldn't have told you back then, I didn't see it, I didn't know it, but I had already begun to trade the every shred of self-respect or God-given talents or potential or gifts that I had for the effect that alcohol produced. Laying it on the table, giving it away, trading it away for the effect that alcohol produced. I would have told you I was doing it willingly, just the next indicated thing. And a year later, I was admitted to a mental hospital. And by that time, any dreams or hopes that I had just been pretty much shattered. And this was not a treatment center, it was a mental hospital. So they were not talking to me a lot about alcohol or alcoholism. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child. I was alternately violent and withdrawn and living with a level of frustration down in my gut I did not know how to talk about. In fact, it wasn't until I got to hear a tape of who I now know was Cubby Selby talking about feeling like a scream looking for a mouth. And I thought, oh my God, you know. But that was many years later. And so like I said, it's a mental hospital. It's not a treatment center. So a lot of my roommates had real illnesses, real manic depression, real schizophrenia, the real deal. And that stands above, beside, and beyond alcoholism. You know, that is a whole different deal. Some people have both. And some people just have that. And so untreated, when I've got no booze and I've got no steps or fellowship or God in my understanding, it takes a little while to sort that out, you know. So in the meantime, they're giving me daily nutritional supplements, Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane, sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I became intimately familiar with five-point restraints, and that's what I look like at 15. And if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy was the boys. I was always looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me, and boys were, you know, some of my favorites. And my favorite boys were those sexy, smoldering types, you know the kind. They just sit back there and simmer. You know what I mean? You just never really knew when they were going to blow up. And I used to find them very exciting. Now, today I know that feeling is fear, so I stay away. But I didn't know that back then. The trouble with guys like that in the nut house is that they're usually hiding there they're hiding from a junior prison sentence. They don't want to go to California Youth Authority. Maybe some of you guys are in here, you know that whole route. But anyway, so they end up in the mental hospital and they try to lay low, but they got nothing. And they end up blowing up. Like my first boyfriend ended up blowing up and throwing a big chair through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. And my next boyfriend ended up blowing up and throwing a nurse through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. And so that was progressive too. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life. You know, music playing in the background of all this drama going on. Like, we'd play those sentimental jailhouse songs like, "Who, when will I see you again?" And press our little faces up against the big bay window of the girls' unit, looking out at them, looking back at us. Living in that sweet spot of anticipation, right there. Yeah, right there, and if only, as soon as I get there. Never in the getting it. Never. As soon as I get it, I got to get another one. What was I thinking? Always in the if only, when I, if I. I didn't understand what I came looking for, I came looking with. That what I was looking for was already inside me. And every spiritual practice I've ever come in contact with, they say the same thing. Our big book says it. In deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. In the last analysis, it's only there that he may be found. And Chuck C. used to say it real simple. What I came looking for, I came looking with. You know, it's already in here. But I didn't know that. So I'm always looking out there for what I think is going to fix me. And the trouble with that is I'm always about half a bubble off what it is I think I see anyway. Like, I'd mistake arrogance for confidence. I'd mistake sex for love. Mistake brute strength for strength of character. Get it up in my hot little hands and it would dissolve where I stood because it wasn't it. I had to come to AA to learn that it's when I'm thinking of you, constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. That's what makes that feeling, that illusion of separation disappear. I didn't know it back then. Always pursuing. Like sand slipping through my fingers. One afternoon, I was sitting outside on a smoke break bench. I was watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. He's the one who threw the chair through the window, and he's gone. He's going. I'm never going to see that guy again. And I am devastated. You know, I mean, because this was a real relationship, you know, 2-3 weeks or something. You know what I mean? And then, you know, because nut house love is pretty intense. You know, you get a lot done in a couple of weeks. And so I'm never going to see him again. And I'm just channeling Greta Garbo and feeling really sorry for myself and smoking my tragic cigarettes and, you know, just digging down deep into the mire. And just inside the girls' unit, I could hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch Me in the Morning," then just walk away. Oh my God. It took me a while to realize I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. Because it's the way I saw my life, always looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me. And I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the unit where they put the patients they just don't know what to do with anymore. I just made myself at home and moved in. Once in a while, I'd get thirsty enough to where I'd find my way over the gate or under the fence or some way, you know, out to the outside and go party for a week or two and come back in the front door of that place. Why? Because that's where I live. I live in the nut house. You know, I was supposed to be there 2 weeks, and I ended up being there for a year, you know, just like I said, moved in. By the time I got to the last unit, I was just pretty tired, and I felt like I was dying, you know. I was no longer bathing or getting dressed, because you don't have to do that to date in the nut house. And I had casts on both my arms up to my shoulders because I'd been cutting, because that was just a whole different way of dealing with my life. And somewhere along the line, I had begun to surrender to the thought that maybe I am just one of those little nut house lifers that gets to get out every now and then, but I am always, always going to end up back inside. Is that a battery?
Yeah, I'll get
home. Okay. So, I ended up going over the wall of that place. You know, I had my boyfriend, who had been discharged just a couple weeks earlier, waiting on the other side in his car, and I climbed up over the fence and over the chimney and came back down the other side, and I always entertain myself by thinking about the fact that I had a boyfriend who had been discharged 2 weeks earlier, waiting on the other side of that fence for his girlfriend to come crawling up over the fence and over the chimney to crawl over from the nut house and get in his car and drive away with him. You know, perhaps it's no big deal to you, but it was to me. It's, I don't know. Anyway, I was 16. He was 21 or 22. I was coming off Thorazine. He introduced me to cocaine, and woohoo! I think it was just too much of a contrast for him, and he couldn't take it. You know, it was. It was just about 2 weeks that we lasted. We lasted about 2 weeks, and then my probation officer, oddly enough, knew exactly where to find me, and it hurt my feelings later on to find out that he'd called her. You know, come get her, she's right here. And I spent most of my adolescence in one lockup or another, you know, a mental hospital, a rehab, and in between sets in juvenile hall, sitting in front of a judge, waiting for placement. You know, my dad used to say, "I think they're just trying to buy you some time, Carla." And maybe he's right. You know, maybe that's... Thank you.
Sorry about that.
You know, he might be right. I come from a family where my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17. My baby brother died of drug addiction and alcoholism when he was 30 years old. And my last remaining sibling lives in Wisconsin, and when she's not drinking, she's on the Vicodin maintenance program, so maybe I got lucky, you know. I ended up in a girl's home at the end of all of this, and here's where I'm just going to tell you that I've always believed in a power greater than myself. I have always known that there is some energy, some force, some larger intelligence, some spirit of the universe that existed, that some energy that runs in and around and through us. I could feel it as a small child laying in my room. I couldn't identify it, I couldn't describe it, and I couldn't really tap into it for very long. You know, I could feel the love. We'd go to church, I could feel the love, and then some challenge would come down in our family, and I would pull the shade down between me and the sunlight of the Spirit. I did that. I roll up my sleeves, I take charge of the management of my own life, and I pull the shade down between me and the sunlight of the Spirit. And for instance, I was born into a Southern Baptist family, and that religion worked very well for my mother till the day she died. You know, she loved it. I couldn't hear it. It was me. I couldn't hear it. You know, and I'm not somebody either that you're going to hear say you have to choose between religion or spirituality. I think you can have both if you want. Religion, as far as I'm concerned, is the practice of your spirituality, and you want to do it with a bunch of like-minded people, that's great. I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in the fourth grade, you know, but I'm about as deep as a mud puddle, you know. If it's not working right now, I got to go. We've got to just keep moving. But I was very infatuated with the ceremony of it all, and just right on the surface. And so for a couple of years, I burned black candles and prayed to the other guy for a while, you know, just hedging my bets, really, you know. I just wanted to be on the side that was winning. Yeah, that was it. And then the television series Kung Fu came out. Some of you guys might remember that show. I know some of you guys are old enough to remember that show. David Carradine, ironically, played a Buddhist priest named Kane. And that guy walked the Wild West in bare feet. You know what I mean? He was tough. You know, nothing but the clothes on his back and a little bag of, I don't know what was in that bag on his belt, but he looked pretty peaceful, didn't he? And he'd walk from town to town, and because he looked different, he'd be met by a whole group of guys, hostile. You know, and they'd come at him, and they'd assault him verbally. And he'd stand there ever so elegantly, and pearls of wisdom just rolled off his tongue. One or two sentences, you know, just boom. And you'd watch their faces change, and they'd go off to help people. And I thought, oh my God, that is real power. That is real power. And we know power when we see it, right? Can't always engage it, can't always tap in, but we know it when we see it, don't we? Then he'd walk to another town, and because he looked different, again, a whole group of guys, hostile, come and attack him physically this time. They'd get on him, come at him. And man, when they did that, he kicked their ass, and I wanted what he had. You know, to me, he looked like the perfect personification of strength and serenity, and wasn't that what I was looking for? Power. So I've got this going on in my head. I get to this girl's home when I've just turned 17, and I've always been infatuated with the spirit of the 60s. You know, I was 12 in 1969, so they were over by the time I got out in the world. But I used to watch TV, and I saw those people. Those people from the 60s did not take crap. You know, they did not take any. They united, they marched, they stood up, they played that beautiful marching music, that peace, love, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Cream, and Blind Faith, and Traffic, right? Remember those guys? And they had that beautiful marching music. And so I get to this girl's home, and I meet my roommate, and she's on the same page, and we're looking for the spirit of the universe. Always, always been looking for that. Alcoholics aren't the only people looking for spiritual food, but the stakes for us are different, and not everybody finds it in a bottle like we did. You know, for so long, it just felt, I mean, alcohol was so much quicker than a prayer, right? Wasn't a drink just quicker than a prayer? Got my answer right now, and if it's not the one I want, I don't even care anymore. Alcohol did it all. So all of our friends told us that those people had moved to Oregon, that San Francisco had gone to seed, and you got to go to Oregon where God might be. And so we did. We went out that second story window of that girl's home, down the tree and into Randy's truck and off to Oregon where God might be. And I don't know about you, but I never went anywhere new thinking, let's go screw this up too. I always went somewhere thinking, I'm going to roll up my sleeves. We're going to start out fresh, clean slate. We are going to do it right this time. We're going to Oregon, Eugene, Oregon. We are going to get back to the land. Now, I am from L.A., so I don't know what I thought I was going to get back to, but I am going to get to it, right? And we get up there, we plant a garden in the front yard, and that's where I learned that when they talked about hoeing in Oregon, they meant with a tool. It was just a whole different thing. And two things happened while I was up there that I certainly couldn't see while it was happening. I had to see it from my point of view when I got sober. But two things were happening. And one was we couldn't drink the way that we needed to drink all the time. You know, when I was trying to lay low, I'm a terrible thief, go without alcohol for a few days. And already at 17, by that time, you take alcohol away from me and I've got not got steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, no sufficient substitute for that relationship with alcohol, and I am restless, irritable, and discontent. My life quickly becomes your fault. And when I could drink the way that I needed to drink, I was always overshooting the mark. And that was happening again and still at 17. My relationship already developed. Already that developed. And our book talks about that. You know, many of us showing symptoms and signs of alcoholism long before we're ready, willing, or able to do anything about it. Way before. My friends had to ask me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot. And I ended up in the roundabout way in my father's house, and he had to ask me to leave too. You know, we'd get up at the same time every morning, and he'd go to work, and I'd go sit in his den, and I'd drink from his liquor cabinet, and he'd come home in the afternoon and see me sitting in the very spot where he'd left me that morning, and I'd see that look in his eyes. He was brokenhearted, and I'd have nothing to say for myself. There was no solution, and there was not even the slightest hint of a promise that I was going to do any different. Alcohol was my solution, and I wasn't letting it go, not for anybody. As much as I might want to, as much as I might hate the fact that I know that I'm hurting you, as much as I might hate the fact that we can't have a relationship because I've got a relationship with alcohol, but I can't stop. My father came to me right before my 18th birthday, and he said, "I'm not going to watch you die, and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go." And on my way out the door, all I could remember is that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And I know today I must have misunderstood, because I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard. And there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I can promise you that. I was 18 years old, starting my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would just go wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party, and some days it was surviving, and not a lot of hope about it getting any different. In fact, today, even today, when I drive down Sunset Boulevard and I see that old, same old bus stop at the corner of Sunset and Poinsettia, and I see a whole new generation of the same girl sitting out there with very little hope about it getting any different, I still get to say a prayer for her that maybe someday she'll get to find what I found here in AA if alcoholism is her problem. But I sure say a prayer of gratitude for myself, because I am not there anymore. No matter how difficult it gets, or no matter how uncertain things get in my life over the last 30 years, I have not been there. And for that, I am really grateful. A few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name. And 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name, but I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my 8-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly when I was making that list. I knew, you know, I had no resentment against him, but I had caused harm. You know, I had been that proverbial tornado. His only crime was that he tried to help me. No strings attached, just tried to help me. And I went through his life like that proverbial tornado, spiritually, physically, mentally, materially, in every way. So I knew I had done harm, and after I made that first round of amends to my family at about 9 months sober, which incidentally was about the time that the obsession to drink was lifted for me, I wanted to go find that guy and make amends to him if I could. And I went everywhere I knew to look, and of course I didn't find him. And my sponsor finally said, "You know, you're going to leave that alone. If you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him, but in God's time, not yours. You know, you're kind of chasing your tail now, so just leave it alone and move on. You know, if you really want to keep changing the way you're living and keep doing what you're doing, take the steps, do this, sponsor people, and try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there?" And, you know, that's not in the big book, but it's a great idea, you know. To tell you the truth, when I got here, I did not need a lot of convincing in that direction. You know, I knew when I got here I had no self-respect. I knew when I got here that some of you did. I could see it on you. I also knew I hadn't the slightest ideas how to get there, how to be that. You know, our book talks about us having moral and philosophical convictions galore, and I want to be that, and I am stuck with this. And I love that essay on the seventh step that Bill wrote, where he talks about when character and comfort collide, that we go for comfort every time, every time. And I knew that. I knew that. And I still didn't have a solution, not on my own. I had to watch you. I had to listen to you. I had to take some direction from somebody else. So those little nuggets like, you know, this is what it looks like. Hi, how you doing? Get to all the women first in the room. And then talk to the men, but from an arm's length. Shake their hand. You know, don't force somebody to hug you. A lot of us come from some really difficult places. And it takes a little while to get that trust and to feel okay. You want to project that it's safe to hug, but it doesn't always feel that way. So right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town. It was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God it's not about what I think it's or how I feel. It's what I do that matters. You guys taught me that a long time ago. I love showing up. I love showing up and not knowing what's going to happen. Even when I'm a little bit scared about it, even when I'm a little bit nervous about it, I love to do it because the results unfold and I'm just like, one more time, tapping into that energy that's God. You know, God comes in so many forms, and if I stay awake to it, it's always speaking through you or speaking through circumstance or speaking in some way. And I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. You know what I mean? Like, it just didn't ever seem to matter. And but don't dare not invite me, right? You know, you got to invite me, but I'm not going. So anyway, I go and I give this talk, and of course I feel better when it's over, and I've done what I said I was going to do, which I still agree is one of the most spiritual things I can do. One of the most spiritually reinforcing things I can do is to do what I say I'm going to do and be where I say I'm going to be. And I get a kick out of it every time. And so I gave the talk, and when the thank you line came through at the end of that meeting, this man stopped and he said, "Hey, where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety and I with almost 13. And only a very well-organized, loving spirit of the universe could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get it done, just couldn't get it done on my own steam. And even if I had kind of, you know, made it, kind of forced it and made it happen, with my own energy, he wasn't sober yet in my first year of sobriety, so maybe he wouldn't have got it quite the way he did when he had some sobriety under his belt. So I got to take him out, and I took him to dinner and made those direct amends. We had a long talk, a long sit down, and when it was all over, he said, "Carla, that's long forgotten, long forgiven. I just can't believe you're still alive." And, you know, he's right. If we're in this room tonight, I believe we're the lucky ones. You know, because somehow, some way, inside the smallest breath of a moment, we got to slip through that window of grace long enough to come in here and sit down and take a few actions. Maybe we didn't even feel like taking the actions. We did it anyway. I did something different, and I got to stay. And I don't know why some people don't get it. I can't even begin. It's not even a judgmental thing. I think that sometimes God just lets the really tired ones go home. You know, I just, I can't spend a lot of time trying to explain it to myself, but I feel like I feel better with that one. That was a long time to come, and I left Hollywood, and, you know, just suffice it to say, I'm the kind of a drunk who sleeps by the side of the road and calls it camping. You know, I think I'm on a spiritual quest, and I am delusional, you know, and I had a boyfriend who, we were both in love with the idea of peace and love and all that stuff. We just couldn't stop knocking the heck out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love. And so we beat each other up and down the California coast, and we pitched a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came. And then we moved into a roofless cabin just north of Grants Pass. Our spiritual advisor had invited us, and he lived up the hill in the plastic tent. This is not your Uncle Joe's fishing cabin. This was an old mining claim made of logs and holes in the wall, and we patched up the holes and threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight, and then the baby came. And we had this little girl, and see, I'd had enough therapy to know that, you know, you've got to break the cycle. If you're going to, you know, change the way everything, you got to break the cycle. And, you know, I am getting my clothes and shoes out of a box behind a store, and I think I'm going to become a better parent than I had. And I start drinking, and she slides way down the priority scale. It's first. No matter how much I love you, it comes first. And she got in the way of one of her fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her up the road where it's got to be better somewhere else. And up until then, I'd been a little bit institutionalized, been just really used to being locked up and living in the shadows and living not out in the world and certainly not out in the marketplace. And now it was time. And so my first legitimate work was in the bars as a cocktail waitress and a bartender. And to me, it just seemed like it was cosmically efficient. You know, it just never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? And it allowed me to kind of slide in. And in the beginning, I didn't work at bad places. You know, it was pretty good places. But I still couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time. So we lived in the rent by the week motels up there and My kid became one of those kids that you see in her t-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because the mom's not paying attention. And after a while, I drug that kid again from pillar to post, and we ended up back down in L.A. I was renting a room for my aunt in Covina, about 35 miles away from my job in Hollywood, working at another bar. Again, not a bad place to work. It's me. I'm the common denominator. And my daughter was almost 4 years old by then, and every afternoon I'd kiss her goodbye, and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood, and I'd get thirsty about Arcadia, about 20 miles in or so, you know. And I'd pull in off onto Huntington Drive, and I'd into a place called the First Cabin, and I'd stop in there, and I'd have my afternoon primer drink, so shots of Corbel Gold and Bud Vax that got me ready to go do my shift. Every afternoon, like clockwork. And then I'd get up off the bar stool and go out to Hollywood and drink with everybody and pour drinks till the wee hours of the morning, and I'd crawl back home and start all over again. And one afternoon, I kissed my girl goodbye like I had done for months on end, and I stopped at that same bar and had those same shots of Gold and same Bud Vax. And to this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before except for 24 hours, because I didn't hate the job I was going to, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool this day, and I drank those drinks, and this time I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop long enough to get up and go see about the job, and I couldn't stop long enough to go see about the kid. So I sat on the bar stool and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia for about a month there until I fell into another job in another dive bar. And I had to stop calling the kid to find out how she was doing, because she kept asking me those hard questions like, "Mommy, when are you coming to get me?" And I had no answer for that. You know, it just seemed like in my heart of hearts that I knew she was better off where she was. And I married this man, my drinking partner, because I thought that maybe if I made my life look like yours was, maybe I could get it back together again. You know, move indoors on kind of a regular basis and put it together so that I could get the kid back and we'd have a normal, regular, healthy household. And he and I got married about the time we should have split up, and we moved into that apartment and we became the neighborhood entertainment, and we settle our arguments with a shotgun. Whoever got to the gun first won. And that's just how we did it. I went to my first AA meeting with black eyes and broken ribs again. And I have a friend who says it wasn't so much the yets that bothered him. It was the, "Oh no, not agains. Not again, and again, and again." And I found this AA meeting that night, this one particular night, and it was a perfectly wonderful AA meeting. It was there then, it's still there. And I went there with everything but willingness, everything but readiness. And that's something you can't give me or make me. You can't make me ready. I got it. We all have to take that walk on our own. We can talk to you. We can give you information. We can plant seeds. We can do all of that. But we each in us have to come to that point. That's the beauty. And maybe that's a little bit of the downside too. You know, it's painful to watch when somebody doesn't. And I don't remember a lot about that meeting that night, but I know it was a woman speaker, and she talked, and somewhere in her talk she said that somewhere during her drinking career she switched to beer, so I did. You know, because after all, the representative from Alcoholics Anonymous suggests we switch to beer. And I thought it was fine, because beer's not really drinking, is it?
No.
I didn't think beer was drinking. I mean, it's got all that wheat and hops and barley in it. It's kind of like a whole grain breakfast food, if you ask me. And gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. You know, it allowed me to get a little further into my day before I fell out completely. And so I drank beer for the next couple of years. And I got my daughter back, for better or worse, when she was 8 and a half. And I didn't get sober till she was almost 10. And it was just on and on and on, and more of the same, and more of the same. You know, I love that beautiful little understatement that we all have our own version of, whether you were, you know, whether you got sober and you're from some wealthy community, from an empire you built from the ground up, and you're a bazillionaire, or somebody who ended up down in Skid Row and it had nothing. But we all come to that beautiful understatement, or we all know what it is, when Bill said, "Gradually things got worse." We all know what that means. And we moved across town to this little apartment in Pasadena, my husband and I and my daughter, and just this tiny little place. And one more Saturday afternoon, the cops were in the driveway one more time, and the neighbors are watching us one more time, and the kid's almost 10 years old, and she's standing over in the corner, she's scared to death one more time. Her life is blowing up, and nobody planned for it to happen that day. Nobody planned this. We all woke up that morning thinking, if everybody will be cool, we'll all be all right. If everybody will just do what they're supposed to do, we're all going to be okay. And we couldn't ever keep that. The cops left. They took the gun this time. My husband left for the last time. It's me and the kid and the booze, and I still can't stop drinking. And see, here's where a hard drinker might take a look at their life and say, you know what? I am tired of this. I am really, really sick of this. And maybe they'd even have to go help get some help detoxing for a week or two, maybe two, you know. Come back home, they'd go back to work, they'd have a story to tell if somebody asked them, but they would move on. But me as an alcoholic, what I do is I pull the 12-pack closer to the couch so I don't have to keep getting up to go get another drink. Because
yeah.
See, I drink through the circumstances of my life. I drank through drug addiction. I drank through alcohol, through homelessness. I drink through. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to affect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, maybe I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. You know, those circumstances that seem to fall together for the good of everybody without me having my hands on them. Those situations. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard that whole fight go down that day. And she came over a couple days later and brought me a big book and a 12 and 12. And she knocked on my door. She came in. She sat down on my couch and she told me her story. You know, like our book says, just a woman properly armed with the facts about herself. She talked about her and her drinking, and in her story I heard me. And I had also seen for the last year her walking around. And I had encountered her a couple of times, and I saw that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what impressed me more about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And that got my attention. I don't know how you do that, you know. Because when I've got no booze, and I've got no steps or fellowship or God, am I understanding, no sufficient substitute, I feel like you stripped the coating off my wires. I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And my self-centered head closes in on me from there. So much so that even though I know a couple of things by now about booze, I know that I can no longer guarantee if I'm going to have 2 or 22. I've known that for a long time. I know that I no longer have to invite trouble. It seems to come to visit unsolicited, doesn't it? And I know that the window of relief has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. Even though I know all of that, I know that at some point I'm going to get to that point of pain or intensity that I am going to have no choice but to pick up that first drink. And I'll take that drink and it will take the next. So I didn't know how her 12 little thinly veiled Sunday school sentences were going to have any effect on me in the face of what I'd become. It just seemed so weak, like I'd heard it all before. You know, those things are nice, but man, when it comes right down to it, a drink is so much quicker than a prayer. I don't understand all that God's will stuff and everything and wait, and if he likes you, you get this, and if you don't, and you never know when that is or what that is or how it works. Oh, but Father Tom Weston said something one time that really, really rang with me. He said, you got to be pretty sick and tired to find us interesting. And I was getting pretty sick and tired, you know, I was getting pretty interested. And so I didn't get sober that day. It was about a week and a half later. I just didn't go back and buy any more booze. And exactly what I thought was going to happen happened. I got sick. And I shook it out one weekend. My daughter was gone somewhere, and I just didn't get up and go anywhere. I sat in that apartment all weekend and into Monday and into Tuesday. And by Tuesday afternoon, I was stark raving sober. And I went back to my neighbor instead of the store, and I asked her what to do, and she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, California, and that became my first home group. And it was so, you know, there was just that's all it took was a surrender at a time, you know, okay, go up to the meeting. And I went up to the meeting, and I sat way back by the open door and the exit sign, just in case. But I sat in there. I sat there and I listened and I heard what was going on in the room, and I loved it. I loved it and hate and was afraid of it at the same time, you know, because I don't know if it's going to work for me. I don't know if I'm going to get as happy about making coffee as you guys seem to be, you know, eating cake. But I heard you talking to each other in a very kind way, you know, like, how you doing? Did you get that 4-step done yet? Or you have a sponsor yet? Do you need a ride home? Would you like a cup of coffee? How's your lawn, Joe? What? Your lawn? What? You know, just talking about stuff, you know? And the thought occurred to me, I was moved, you know? The thought occurred to me like, oh my God, could my life ever be so elegant and simple as to be concerned about a lawn? You know, like the smell of fresh cut grass, that that elegant simplicity. Because it seemed like up until then, my whole life had been about foraging and scraping the bottom just to get to another day. And all these years later, you know, being sober, if I were to go out, I'm not so afraid of dying. I would pray for death, I think, after not long. I'm afraid of that, living that scrapey little life again, that scraping, foraging, bitter, crooked, hurtful life. I respect that. The secretary of that meeting did something very nice for me. She walked back to the back of the room toward me, and she handed me that portion of chapter 11 that we read at the end of a lot of meetings, you know, a vision for you. And I took it from her. I said, yes, and I read. And as I read, I came to the room just a little bit more, just like I do every time I say yes to something you ask me to do. Will you lead? Will you read? Will you pick up that newcomer? Will you make the coffee? Yes. And I had to drink one more time after 89 days. I took my first 90-day chip. I took my only 90-day chip on Christmas Eve. And so I'm very hopeful around the holidays. Vince Yo used to say it's not a requirement that we be miserable around the holidays. And I know a lot of us are going through stuff. But the promise of Alcoholics Anonymous in these steps is that we don't have to hold on. Those feelings and those sadnesses and those challenges that happen that we walk through, they take their place in our lives and they become a beautiful tapestry. And we have this bucket of experience that we just hold, and we don't even know how long we're going to hold it, but somebody will come up and ask us for a drink, and we give it to them, a drink of the water of our experience. So I got to come in, and I want to tell you this, too. If you do happen to go out, the question is never going to be, are you welcome back? You're always welcome back, always. The question is going to be, can you get back across the threshold of Alcoholics Anonymous long enough and far enough to come all the way in and sit all the way down and do what you have to do to stay here? And I've seen people lose big time, you know, and it's hard to watch them come back. So I started to take the steps of my sponsor, and I made that first round of amends to my family, like I told you, at about 9 months. And again, I didn't have to feel like being here. I just got to do the stuff. I did the stuff, and they worked. It worked anyway. You know, I didn't have to be happy about it. It was not a requirement that I like what I had to do here. I just did it. And right around 9 months sober, in the middle of making my amends, that horrible obsession to drink was finally lifted. Finally lifted. And for me, it was strong. And I know that you guys know what obsession for alcohol feels like, what it sounds like a woodpecker, like rat-a-tat-tat on the inside of your head. You know, for me it was. For me it was constant. For me it was like that, the kid who's following his mom around in the grocery store wanting chocolate. You know, that kid. That. You know what I mean? Mom, 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 mom. Let's have a drink on the way to the meeting, have a drink on the break, have a drink on the way home, let's have a drink, nobody will know, la 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 la. And it was gone, the steps expelled the obsession to drink. It doesn't qualify us to be an alcoholic, to be obsessed about a tree or be obsessed about anything. You know, Calvin Klein made billions of dollars on the word obsession because every human being on earth practically understands what obsession is. But what we have, our common problem in here, our common problem to which we apply our common solution, is that horrible, horrible allergy to alcohol that happens when we're drinking, that horrible obsession for alcohol that happens when we're not. And together, those things are just insurmountable without help for me. It's not a requirement to be anything else in here, although we are, and all of that makes interesting fodder for the coffee table after the meeting, you know, doesn't it? It helps us a lot. But I am so glad that the shingle, that when the sign said AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, on the outside of the door, that when I came in, that's what you guys were talking about. That's what I needed to recover from. walking around either drinking or thinking about drinking all the time. Then other women started asking me to sponsor them, and I got to tell you, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. Because in your eyes, I see forgivability. I see redeemability. I see hope and growth where I don't always see it in myself. I don't see any dumb questions. I don't hear any dumb questions come from your heart. And we sit, and as I take you through the steps, I'm going through them again. After a couple of years, I'd had you guys, and my daughter didn't have anybody. I was busy being wonderful in Alcoholics Anonymous, 2 and 3 meetings a day, you know, and working, and trying to raise this kid. And, you know, fun for me when I first got here was paying rent for more than a month in a row. You know, I was like, yeah, you know, let's do that. And but it says right up front in our book that on page 19, it says that a more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. So if I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. It's for me to practice these principles at home as well. And my daughter, like I said, I was almost 2 years sober, and she was 11 years old, starting to come home at all hours of the night, if she came home, beat up and bloody. She'd been jumped into a gang and starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. It was time to get her some big help. And so I had to put her in a treatment center, and because I couldn't do it at home alone. I just couldn't get it. It wasn't working. And so I put her in this treatment center, and I was afraid because I didn't know if it was the right thing or not. And I stayed away when they told me to, and I went there when they told me to. And you guys kept telling me mountains are moved a spoonful at a time, you know, that every day I just get up and I give it my best spoonful, you know. And it was slow going, but she started to get better. She was in there for about 6 months, and you know, it's kind of not fair. In about an hour, I'm going to get up here and I'm going to throw 60 years of living at you, you know, before and after sobriety, like some bad episode of Law and Order. You know, we got the law and we got the order, and boom, we're good. You know, and the newcomers are just like, whoa, it only took her an hour to get all, but there was a long period of reconstruction ahead, and you know, it took a long time. My daughter's 39 years old now, and it took till she was about 23, 24 years old for us to get really on a good foot to where all of that was repaired. And you know, she's 39 years old now, and just a few years ago, I sat with my husband and my amended family, and my husband, and by the way, and I got together when we were both 21 years sober, and I was 51 years old, so hang in there. And really glad I didn't stand around tapping my foot waiting for that one to happen, you know what I mean? Like, you can't get sober without a boyfriend. Oh. And I sat with him and my father and you know, nieces and nephews and her other side of the family, and watched her collect her master's degree. And just a couple of years ago, when that horrible terrorist thing happened out in San Bernardino, she was a therapist on the crisis impact team who went in with the police department and all the other therapists and sat with the families who had been affected. And then, like, the same thing with the Vegas thing that happened not long ago, you know, sat with those families and helped them begin to put the pieces of their lives back together. That's who she is. And it's not lost on me that she's adept at crisis impact after long exposure to me. But whether she is who she is because or in spite of me, I know that I get to be a privileged witness in her life and in the lives of the people who ask me for help. That's who I get to be these days. And it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can be that. She has two of the most beautiful grandkids I've ever seen. You know, one is going to be 17, and we're going to celebrate our birthdays together tomorrow. And the other is 22 and or 21 and just graduated from Arizona State. And so life is good. There's been some repair done, you know, but slow going. That's where the fellowship really comes in. When I was 5 years sober, I came home one night after the gym, and I went to bed as usual, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and there was a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth, and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord, and he tied my hands behind my back, and he raped me, and he robbed me that night in my room. And I want to tell you that at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger God than I got here with. You know, little by little by little. I came here with all those convoluted ideas about God and really not being able to make contact. And my friend Susan said, why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be in your life? You know, see him from all angles. See where he comes from. Don't expect. Just watch, you know. And little by little, you know, it started to happen through service, through taking these steps, through prayer, through asking, through watching. And so there's this man on my back in the middle of the room in the middle of the night, and I have a stillness inside me. Even though I had fight or flight going on, there was also a stillness, and I listened to that, and I watched. And at a strategic time, a couple hours later, I went for the door, and I couldn't get out because my bolt lock wouldn't let me, but we got into a little wrestling match, and instead of making him mad, it caused him to drop the knife, and he went out the same kitchen window he came in. And it turned out that I knew this guy. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back. And then I watched him join the church, leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I chose to learn from that is, while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, to make use of what they offer, Alcoholics Anonymous is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my illness. It's where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. Anything I do as far as spiritual practice that goes above and beyond Alcoholics Anonymous is in addition to and not instead of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still need to stand at the door and shake the hand of the newcomer and sit with the newcomer and take the steps with them and smell the booze on the breath sometimes and see the look in their eye of desperation. I still need to see that. John A. from Texas always talks about keeping the moment alive. Keeping the moment alive that where I got to get sober, the moment of where desperation and hope came together. Alcoholics Anonymous is where we do that. Church in general, spirituality, whatever your faith may be, you know, they can address it in, they can address spirituality in a very, very general way. It applies to everybody. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we take spirituality and we aim it right at alcoholism. One purpose, one requirement, not a requirement to be anything else in here, because we do one thing well, no matter where we come from, coming in here young or old or rich or poor. That's the unifying thing right there. There was a trial that followed. They caught him, and there was a trial that followed a little while later, And as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be. So we had to get someone to testify on my behalf. And by that time, I was working at a big fancy investment firm downtown Los Angeles, a place I never would have walked in the front doors of years before. I would have had no business being there. And people like Henry Kissinger walked the halls of this place. You know, it was big. And I'm there, too. I'm walking undetected. You know, little over 5 years sober, and because I'm showing up doing what they asked me to do. So the department head there volunteered to come and testify on my behalf, and they told him all about who I used to be. And he said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late, and she was where she said she was, see. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he'd experienced it through me. And then it was my turn to testify. And you know, up until then, my sponsor Marguerite had been telling me that I needed to forgive this guy. And I know she's right. I know we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. But at 5 years of sobriety, anger was still my favorite way to respond to fear like that. And it's all about fear, isn't it? Always, 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 it boils down to two things. Fear of not getting, fear of losing, whether it's emotional, spiritual, material. And yet anger is like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. I can't be angry and I can't not be angry on my own. So the seven-step prayer became my mantra every day, all day, when I'd get afraid. So it's my turn. I'm sitting up in the witness stand, and I look out and I see him sitting there at the defense table. And it's a place where I've sat before, and I know I could sit again. If I were to take a drink, maybe not rape, but something equally as destructive. And that prayer at the top of page 67 came to mind. And I think it's just such an important turning point in our fourth step in any inventory that we do. Whether you're doing a fourth or a tenth, they look the same to me. They're just shorter now. So I'm doing a tenth step. It looks like the fourth. It's shorter. And I use the same prayers, you know, same deal, same process. Though we didn't like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, are spiritually sick. He, like me, spiritually sick. He, just like me. I'm not forgiven from a spiritual hilltop. I'm not praying for him with an air of superiority. I'm praying for him because I am just like him. And I've come to believe and come to from my experience that just about everybody I've ever resented, I am being, could be, or have been in the past, that person. And it slows me down. It's got to slow me down from backing off from you. I've got to take a different view. So what happened in that courtroom that day for me was that I believe the forgiveness came. And what happened was we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. And then it took a little while more for the healing, you know, for the nightmares to stop and all of that stuff. But, you know, it's been a long time, been 25 years as of December 2nd, going into the 3rd overnight. So he was sentenced to 20 years, and he did 17. And the detective who worked that case came to me after it was over. And I need to make this point, too, that it wasn't for me to forgive and then just leave it alone. It was for me to forgive and stand up, testify, and have him be accountable to that, too. You know, not just forgive and be a doormat, but to stand up and forgive at the same time. The detective who worked the case came to me after it was over, and he said, "I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it because it seems to be working." And that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. You know, my days every day start on pages 80, it goes from pages 84 through 88. Every day I do them, and I ask my sponsees to do them. Have you done them? Don't just read them. Have you done them? Because what step 10 for me is 1 through 9 all over again, every day, all the time. You know, we don't leave anything out. And I get the review by taking my sponsees through the steps. I still want to work with newcomers all these years later. And pages 84 through 88 in the book have a beautiful, beautiful outline for daily living. I mean, it's all that we need. It's enough to live without anything else. And then if I want to add something to it, I do. And I'm a big reader. I'm a big seeker. I just love God. I love what happens. I love the search. I love the exploration. I love it all. So it's time for me to stop. And if you're new, I hope that you'll come in and stay. You don't have to feel like staying. Just stay. A lot of this stuff, man, my sponsor would give me a lot of direction over time, and it was a rare occasion where I would go, "Yeah, that sounds right. Let me do that." You know, most of the time it was, you know, stomping my foot and not wanting to do it and doing it anyway, and I got to get the results. You don't have to like it to do it, but I hope you stay. Thanks.
All right, let's thank our speaker again.